I am speaking to you from my desk in the Executive Mansion in Albany on a subject that is not in the narrower sense of the word political, but which, because it is connected with government, vitally affects the lives of almost every man, woman, and child in all of the United States. I have constantly reiterated my conviction that the expenditures of cities and states and the federal government must be reduced in the interest of the nation as a whole. I believe that there are many ways in which such reduction of expenditures can take place, but I am utterly unwilling that economy should be practiced at the expense of starving people. We must economize in other ways, but it shall never be said that the American people have refused to provide the necessities of life to those who, through no fault of their own, are unable to feed and clothe and house themselves. The first obligation of government is the protection of the welfare and well-being, the very existence of its citizens. But the federal government has had no continuing policy for dealing with problems of public health and social welfare. In this, as in other activities, of a multiplicity of unrelated agencies have been developed, hit or miss, to deal with aspects of the same problem. The result has been waste of men and money, more costly and less efficient service than we ought to have. The administration has done nothing to reorganize this or other branches of the federal government in spite of campaign promises at the last three presidential elections. I propose to inaugurate a definite long-range plan for dealing with all phases of public health and public welfare, which are a proper concern of the federal government. Let us who have jobs or money or shelter for ourselves and our families share with the less fortunate. If we do this in every community throughout the land, Thanksgiving Day and Christmas Day of 1932 will take on an added significance, the significance of a higher American ideal of social justice.
In this state and in other states, the specter of fear placed before you by the distinguished gentleman who is running against me, placed before you by the Republican speakers throughout the nation. And remember that I draw a sharp line of distinction between the rank and file of splendid American citizens who make up the Republican Party on the one hand, and a leadership of that party which today has proven that it is unfit longer to lead. Now, my friends, you've been told something. You have been told that things might have been worse. That's right. We all know they might have been worse. We might not be here today at all. We might have died of starvation. And you've been told that things may be worse if I'm elected to office. Well, my friends, I say this to you. Yes, things might have been worse. But on the other hand, remember that things might have been a whole lot better. That things should have been better. And more than that, that things will begin to get better when we get a change of administration in Washington on the 4th of March next. Now, it seems to me that an attempt to instill panic into the electorate of this country at this time, at a time when we must all have courage and a firm belief that the American characteristic of finding answers to problems will bring us on the upward trail, to attempt to instill panic into us at this time is a method of campaigning that does little credit to leaders who are still at this moment entrusted with the welfare of the people of the United States. And so we may well ask the question, Are you afraid of a change? I refuse to believe that the people of this nation can be made to fear false bogeymen. The choice is deeper than that. It is a choice between restored order on the one hand and drift on the other. A choice between constructive planning on the other hand and the forces of mismanagement on the other. And my friends, if the nation as a whole wants to know what is wrong with our national government, I will give them the answer in just one word. And that word is the word mismanagement. Views on the subject were widely published and have been subsequently frequently quoted. I said this: I do not see how, as a matter of practical sense, a government running behind $2 billion annually can consider the anticipation of bonus payments until it has a balanced budget, not only on paper, but with a surplus of cash in the treasury. My friends, no one, for political purposes or otherwise, has the right, in the absence of explicit direct statement from me, to assume that my views have changed. They have not. I call definite attention to the fact that just as soon as the Democratic platform pledge is enacted into a law modifying the Volstead Act, a source just as soon as that happens, a source of new revenue amounting to several hundred millions of dollars a year will be made available towards the balancing of the budget. Yes, I refer specifically to a federal tax on beer. A tax that would be raised on the sale of beer in those states and those states only which by state law allow the sale of beer.
Search your memory and see if you can think of one great big public question that's been settled by the present Republican administration. See if you can find one great big public question that they made a reasonably good attempt to settle. Instead of that, and in lieu of it, we're receiving what could be called a program of threat, that if the Republican Party is defeated, return to prosperity will be retarded. I deny that, and I deny it emphatically. And I state from this platform to my nationwide audience that the election of the Democratic ticket is the best way to solve these problems, the best way to bring back prosperity. The election of Roosevelt, of Gandhi.
And now a word. Wait till I get through the paragraph. Now a word as to beer. You good people are in a terrible hurry. let me complete the statement. It's all right. I favor the modification of the Boston Act just as fast as the Lord will let us. The modification of the Boston Act to permit such states as want to authorize the manufacture and sale of beer. And of very, very great importance as a part of that, remember that that is a way to divert $300 million or more by way of taxes from the pockets of the racketeers into the treasury of the United States.
President began this campaign with the same attitude with which he has approached so many of the serious problems of the past 3 years. He sought to create the impression that there was no campaign on at all, just as he had sought to create the impression that all was well with the United States and that there was no depression. The present leadership in Washington stands convicted, not because it did not have the means to plan, but fundamentally because it did not have the will to do. And that is why next week the American people will register their firm conviction that this administration has utterly and entirely failed to meet the great emergency of modern times. You have heard in this very city the president's exhortation that to abandon or to change one letter or one word of his policies would mean the destruction of this great republic. I believe, avoided the delusion that this is a campaign of persons or of personalities. To indulge in such a fantastic idea of my own individual importance would be to betray the common hope and the common cause that has brought us all together this year.
I welcome the privilege of standing on this platform tonight with Governor Roosevelt and saying, what will not be news to him or to the President of the United States, and that is that I support without qualification Roosevelt and Garner for the two highest offices in the gift of the United States. I hope America, chastened by disaster, suffering as she is, will rise to that liberal leadership which will replace suspicion with confidence and which never is afraid. And speaking of being afraid, let me pay my respects to the threats, express or implied, which are now being used to influence our votes. There are more than 10 million of people out of work in this country. Some of them are in want and others threatened with it. Many have lost their homes on mortgage foreclosure. Others are threatened. Many have lost their farms, others are threatened, and so we have millions of people sensitive not only to the conditions of today, but apprehensive of tomorrow. It is no time to make threats, and so I hope that in this election we shall get a true reflex by votes, uninfluenced by fear or favor, of the intelligence and of the intuitions of the great masses of our people. Broadly, I trust the intuitions of the many more than the assumed superintelligence of the few. What we need is a full and free and honest indications of how the millions of this country feel inside themselves. Mr. Chairman, what I am concerned about in this fast-moving world, in a time of great crisis, both at home and abroad, is not so much, I'm not so much concerned about a program as a spirit of approach. Not so much concerned about a mind as a heart. A program lives today and dies tomorrow. A mind, if it be open, may change with each new day, but a spirit and a heart is as unchanging as the tides.
We'd be good, you know. They got us all trained. That's all right.
It looks, my friends, like a real landslide this time. But we have not yet had the returns from the West Coast, and for that reason, I'm making no official or public statement as yet.
Well, Louis, it's all over now. These reports that came in during the evening were all fine and just what we expected. It was only right that we wait until we heard from President Hoover. And we have a wire from him now, which the governor should see immediately, indicating that he concedes the election and congratulates the governor. And I also received a letter a moment ago, or a wire a moment ago, from Everett Saunders, chairman of the Republican Committee, and he too extends Hardy's congratulations. Now it's all over. Congratulations to you.
Well, of course, Jim, when Saunders gives up, it's all over. But there's only one thing that worries me a little. How on earth did you manage to lose those five states?
Well, that's something I'm anxious to know myself.
Bad teamwork, Jim. Bad teamwork.
I am glad of this opportunity to extend my deep appreciation to the electorate of this country, which gave me yesterday such a great vote of confidence. It is a vote that had more than mere party significance. It transcended party lines and became a national expression of liberal thought. It means, I am sure, that the masses of the people of the nation firmly believe that there is great and actual possibility in an orderly recovery through a well-conceived and actively directed plan of action. Such a plan has been presented to you, and you have expressed approval of it. This, my friends, is most reassuring to me. It shows that there is in this country unbounded confidence in the future of sound agriculture and of honorable industry. This clear mandate shall not be forgotten. And I pledge you this, and I invite your help in the happy task of restoration.
The President's main objective is to bring about what he describes as a balanced government. Everyone who's read the history of the country knows that three elements have in turn dominated our government since the earliest days. First, the agricultural element. Then they lost out to the northern industrialists who reached their peak during the palmy days of Mark Hanna. And then after the war, the new group, the financiers and stock sellers. They ruled until the crash came. Now, President Roosevelt believes that the people are now ready and determined to help bring about a balanced government in which none of these three groups will predominate, but each group will share and share alike with the other. And he believes that when all are working together unselfishly and equally, then will we have real economic peace and security. As for the future, no one can predict. But although it is true that a great deal has happened since the 4th of March, I want to assure you, and I speak from knowledge, that President Roosevelt has only begun to fight.
Mr. Howe, in all the 21 years that you and the President have been so closely and constantly associated, can you remember many busier weeks than this one just ended?
Since the inauguration, no one week has been busier than another, because it couldn't be. Ordinarily, peace and quiet reign until just before the end of the session, and Congress develops a high fevered activity and runs around in circles. But this time, there is no return to normal. We started in at the same gait, or even faster than that which the previous session closed.
That's true. There certainly has been no unemployment in your circle in the past 3 months. But Mr. Howe, you promised to let us know all about what's happened each week in Washington, particularly those things which get crowded out of the papers by the sensational stories which fill the first page. What has happened this week that's particularly interesting?
Well, of course, things are a little lonesome in the higher intellectual circles at the moment, because so many of our deep thinkers are on their way to the European conference. We got them off on a boat named the President Roosevelt, which all Europe will think is a compliment to FD. But as a matter of fact, it is named after Teddy and is old enough to have been his christening present. I understand, incidentally, that all the members of the commission demanded a dozen extra pencils and four pads for use on the way over.
Do you mean to work out their plans for bringing about world prosperity?
Not at all. To try and figure out how they could live on the $6 a day, which is the limit the government will allow them. I suppose they've had time to think about economic conferences, but judging from their conversation before they left, I'm convinced that the $6 per day limit was occupying the major part of their thoughts. They had the wonderful idea of renting a cottage out in the suburbs somewhere and pooling expenses. That fell through. Some have thought of the fact you had to hire help. And the suggestion that Senator Pittman and Secretary of State Hull should take turns in cooking the meals and washing the dishes. Met with rather a cold reception.
I think it was.
So they've all gone to hotels except Mr. Cox, who's taking his family along, hiring a whole house. And Mr. Warburg, the advisory group, who's an expert on high finance and has taken probably two houses.
Have you heard from him?
Conservative radiograms from the boat since they left. I can't say we've received any very startling information.
And I suspect that most of them are just recovering from what we call in France mal de mer. Perhaps it's just as well that a bunch on its way to cure a sick world should learn something on the way over about a sick ocean.
I suppose Congress will adjourn pretty soon with the feeling that it's done a lot toward the return of happy days.
Everybody, of course, is a little more cheerful at the prospect of adjournment. But it's hard to tell whether the legislators or the people are happier about this Congress getting through of its jobs. For the moment, the joyous note is rather spoiled by the gloom that has settled over the Budget Department. There are rumors that an additional force of cleaners was called in on Saturday night to mop up the tears shed in the way the Senate spoiled the department's beautifully balanced budget when the Senate tacked on $150 million by reducing the proposed cuts in the veterans' allowances.
How does that affect the general public?
Well, incidentally, that is an action that should be administered to every one of you, because it means that additional taxes will have to be raised, which will amount to about $1.25 for every human being in the United States, directly or indirectly. You can be assured that eventually you will have to dig down and give Uncle Sam $1.25 for yourself and your missus and all the kiddies if you happen to be a man of family, because in the long run, any deficiency of the budget has to be paid for by the people.
Now, Mr. Howe, will you excuse a personal question? I've noticed, as I've been talking with you here, that you seem worried about something. Has anything gone wrong? Are you expecting some sort of an important message? You jump every time anybody comes into the room.
Well, perhaps I better make an honest confession. As long as you've noticed it, I am dreadfully worried.
Is it something you can tell me?
I suppose so. It's about those kittens.
Kittens?
2-3 weeks ago, a lady somewhere out in California wrote me she had 2 highly bred Persian cats who were about to add to the family. And could she name one of the kittens after me? I was flattered and at once agreed. But I haven't heard a word since. I mislaid the letter, so I can't telegraph. And day after day, hour after hour, no word about those kittens. I never realized the anxiety of prospective godparents. If anyone in California has any word, write and let me know. And be sure and tell me how mother and the young ones are getting on and how father stood the strain. It'll be a tremendous relief.
As the 25th president of the National Press Club in the 25th year of its existence, I am privileged to present to you this engraved membership card in the club.
I'm very happy to come here tonight on this Silver Jubilee, and very happy of the coincidence that the National Press Club was founded when my cousin was president in the old days. One of the speakers has mentioned that he was only a partway member because he wasn't sure whether the check that he drew was good or not. I am not quite as far advanced in membership as that, because the only complaint that I have against the new Secretary of the Treasury is that I've had no salary to date and have drawn no checks.
I'm very glad to welcome all of you to Washington. And I wish that I'd had the time and the opportunity of participating in your meetings. I myself was born on a farm, so I know something about it. And it's no news to you when I tell you that the odds are about 1,000 to 1 that you'll never become millionaires in farming. But you'll be doing something that is more important than becoming millionaires. You'll be building up for future generations the soundest kind of American life. And you will know that even if you never make a great deal of money, at the same time, the odds are 1,000 to 1 the other way that you'll never starve. And so, my friends, in about a half a minute, if you would stay where you are,
or turn around, which is it?
Turn around, look the other way.
They want you all to turn around and face the cameras so that we can get this whole thing recorded. It's been fine to see you. Many thanks.
President Roosevelt has just spoken to 1,500 members of Future Farmers of America, a national organization of boys who are studying vocational agriculture. Each state, as well as Hawaii, is represented in this group, who are in Washington attending their annual convention.
We are planning, within a few days, to ask the Congress for legislation to enable the government to undertake public works, thus stimulating directly and indirectly the employment of many others in well-considered projects. Well-considered and conservative measures will likewise be proposed within a few days that will attempt to give to the industrial workers of the country a more fair wage return, to prevent cutthroat competition, to prevent unduly long hours for labor, and at the same time to encourage each industry to prevent overproduction. Much has been said of late about federal finances and inflation, about the gold standard, and francs and pounds and so forth. I should like to make the facts very simple and to make my policy very clear. In the first place, government credit and government currency are really one and the same thing. Behind government bonds, there is only a promise to pay. Behind government currency, we have, in addition to the promise to pay, a reserve of gold and a small reserve of silver. Neither of them anything like the total amount of the currency. If the holders of these promises to pay were all of them to start in to demand gold, the first comers would get gold for a few days or a few hours. And those first comers who would get the gold would amount to about 1/25 of all of the holders of the securities and the currency. The other 24 people out of 25 who did not happen to be at the top of the line would be politely told that there was no more gold left. And so we have decided in Washington to treat all 25 people in the same way, in the interest of justice and in the exercise of the constitutional powers of this government. We've placed everyone on the same basis, in order that the general good may be preserved.